Earlier this week, on the order of Donald Trump, U.S. troops were pulled from Syria and the embedded positions they held with Kurdish forces. And if you recall from the show we did in April of 2018, which will be linked below, the Kurds have been strong allies of the U.S. helping to fight terrorism in the region. After U.S. troops had been removed from their positions, U.S. NATO ally Turkey rolled in and rolled over Kurdish forces going as far as 30 miles deep into Syria in an operation that is being reported to have been greenlit by the U.S. In this episode of Lessons from the Screen, we will be looking at the history between the Kurds and Turkey, why the U.S. pulled out, what has happened since the pullout, and more. Today, we will be talking about the U.S., Turkey, and the Kurds. Welcome back to another episode of Lessons from the Screen, the show where we give you a review of whether or not a show is worth watching, or a document is worth reading, or a book is worth reading, or a GIF is worth sending, or a meme is worth creating, or if any of those things that you like to do through a screen are worth doing. No, I'm joking. But welcome to this Lessons from the Screen, the show where we give you a review of whether or not any particular information that you can get from any particular screen of any particular kind is worth your time. We waste our time, our energy, and our brain power so that you don't have to. And you are welcome. Lessons from the Screen is sponsored by PAX Inc., a black activist, a black activist advocacy and think tank organization with the purpose of increasing the quality of life for black people in America through educational culture shift and economics. You can check them out at www.pactsinc.org. That's PAXinc.org. Leave a review, become a member, make a donation, take a survey. Volunteer, subscribe, do whatever you got to do to help them, because they are doing whatever they can to help you. And I got to say, in the roughly 2 years that I've been doing this show, I think that is the absolute first time I have messed up on the sponsorship part. But you know what we do. You know how it goes. We like to let you see the evolution of the show, as you saw earlier with my little beatbox thing going on. Boom, boom, ch, boom, boom, ch, boom, ch. So, anyways, we just gonna be playing around with things, trying to make it fresh, trying to keep it funky. You know what I'm saying? But anyways, we're gonna get right on into this topic after I done spent the last 3 minutes playing around. And we're going to be talking about Syria, the Kurds, the U.S., Turkey, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So let's jump right on into it. So we are back in the Middle East today with another show on Syria. But a lot has changed since the missile strikes last year that prompted the first show. And if you haven't heard, that show is linked below and goes into detail about the Syrian civil war, the Arab Spring that caused it, and how the different factions in the Syrian civil war have come to play. But today's show does focus on a topic with a tremendous amount of impact in the Syrian civil war and the politics of the region, but it's not a Syrian civil war update show. So the tie-in starts immediately with the U.S. pulling out of an area and leaving its Kurdish allies open to attack by Turkey, who has pushed roughly 30 miles where they want to push 30 miles into Syria in order to destroy the Kurds, first and foremost. But secondary down the list, they want to create a buffer zone that can be used to house some of the 3.6 million refugees that have fled from Syria and into Turkey over the course of the civil war. That's what we know on the surface level. But you know, here on Lessons from the Screen, we never stay on the surface level. We try to dig a little bit deeper to give you some backstory so you have a little bit of a better understanding. So we are going to start with the first question on our minds and go from there. Who are the Kurds, and why would Turkey want to destroy them so badly that they would invade another country? Well, I'm glad you asked. The Kurds are an Iranian ethnic group, one of the largest stateless, depending on who you talk to, ethnic groups in the world today, numbering between 30 and 45 million people. They have their own languages, their own culture, a variety of religious beliefs, and for a time, about 500 years ago, they had their own nation. Well, that's a bit of a stretch to say they had their own nation. Not quite their own nation, although that would be a nice story to tell, you know, because that's the story we like to hear. But what they had was a geocultural region in the Middle East that was named after them. That place was known as Kurdistan. And while as a people, they have been able to be grouped together throughout most of their history, most of their modern recent history, it wasn't until the Ottoman Empire and the Iranian Empire began to clash in the early 1500s that the many tribes that had come to be known as Kurdish experienced a loss in their ability to be grouped together. The Iranian Empire controlled some of Kurdistan while the Ottoman Empire controlled most of the rest. The Ottoman Empire ended up winning that engagement and taking control of all of Kurdistan. And beginning in 1514, when the Ottoman Empire annexed Kurdistan, the region was controlled by the Ottoman Empire, who split the region into districts and appointed local chiefs as governors. Now, this kept the cultural identity and stability of the region and effectively allowed the Kurdish groups to manage themselves under the banner of the Ottoman Empire. So, you know, they sunned them. This isn't to say that this was a peaceful time. The Kurdish people revolted against the Ottoman Empire on several occasions. And in 1606, the Jepulat revolt occurred when a regional ruler was murdered. The stated reason for the murder was arriving late to a battle, but the people believed that he was murdered for being Kurdish. His nephew, backed by the Duke of Tuscany, a region in central Italy, took a force of 30,000 troops against the Ottoman Empire before fleeing and being appointed governor of a province in Hungary. In 1655, another revolt was started when the Ottoman army passed through an area of Kurdistan and committed atrocities against civilians. The leader of the region built an army and launched an attack on the Ottoman Empire. The revolt was put down with 70 Kurds being cut to pieces, dismembered and cut to pieces by swords. These are just two examples of many, not including the brief reconquest by the Iranian forces. But even with the revolts, the Ottoman Empire maintained control over Kurdistan and the system set up before the beginning, totally unchanged. I'm sorry, from the beginning, totally unchanged until the early 1800s. During that time, the Kurds had gained a great deal of influence and power and spread their influence, increasing the size of their autonomous regions. Now, the Ottoman Empire engaged in the Russo-Turkish War from 1829 to 1828, and after the empire lost the war to Russia, the Kurds made a move to free themselves from the Ottoman Empire in 1834. The rising was put down, and the Kurds lost their autonomy. Now, this was done because the Ottoman Empire, following the loss to Russia, realized it needed to modernize itself as a nation. It needed all the different ethnic groups in the Ottoman Empire to see themselves as Ottoman first nationally. These changes and the roughly 40-year period they occurred in were called the Tanzimat. Now, some people have also said that the Ottoman giving credit for these reforms was also occurred. I couldn't find anything to verify or prove that, though. The removal of autonomy caused more issues between the Ottoman Empire and the Kurdish people, and more revolts ensued. In one particular instance, peep game, right? A Kurdish ruler rebelled against the empire to protect his own power in the region. He was defeated and his brother became the ruler. Now this upset his son, who was in line to become the ruler, and his son was told by the Ottoman Empire that if he killed his uncle, he would be made ruler. And so he killed his uncle. And instead of being made ruler, he was executed. Now, the Kurds have songs about this, and in 1864, the Ottoman Empire abolished Kurdistan as an administrative region and as a province. Another revolt in 1880 sought to reunify the region, but as things go, that thing went like they always go. It was put down, 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 down. By the start of the 1900s, the idea of nationalism that the Ottoman Empire was trying to preach was defeated by ethnic identities. And that's something that we need to come to grips with. Ethnic identities are always going to win. History has shown us that. People are always going to see themselves. They're always going to congregate in cultural groups, segments and blocks that are familiar to them. And there isn't much you can do about that in terms of not having them do that. Now, you can try to get them to be tolerant of other groups, but you cannot stop people from wanting to be in groups with like-minded people. It's just not going to happen. But anyways, the idea of nationalism in the Ottoman Empire was defeated by ethnic identities. And these identities had not only defeated concepts of national citizenship, but also defeated powerful concepts of religious unity. The Ottoman Empire attempted to negate the cries for ethnic nationalism by giving the powerful voices of the Kurdish community powerful positions in the government. And this worked and held the loyalty of the Kurds through World War I. Now, after World War I, which was fought from 1914 to 1918 and featured the Allies, Britain, France, Russia, Italy, and the United States on one side, and the Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire and Bulgaria on the other side. And although there were numerous smaller nations that also participated, with the total national involvement count reaching 32, the Ottoman Empire, which had been on the losing side, was forced to sign some documents. And that's when things get a bit interesting. You see, Kurdish voices have been trying to use the defeat of the Ottoman Empire to carve out a section of land for themselves as an officially recognized Kurdish nation. And for a moment, it looked like they were going to be successful with the encouragement of U.S. President Woodrow Wilson. After the Armistice of Mundros was signed, ending hostilities between the Ottoman Empire and the Allies in 1918, ideas and maps began to be presented that had regions of land marked out as Kurdistan. But the Kurds themselves couldn't agree on what should or shouldn't be included in Kurdistan. And that was basically because some of the Kurds wanted to make certain concessions towards the Allied powers, and other Kurds wanted to make other concessions. But they all agreed that they wanted their own chunk of land. They just couldn't agree on the concessions to be made and what land should be considered and what land should not. But the signing of the Treaty of Sevres in 1920 didn't really spell out any sort of Kurdistan nation. But what it did was it left the concept and the idea of Kurdistan to be held on a referendum for later. However, the signing of the Treaty of Sevres caused a surge in national pride as many in the Ottoman Empire felt like they were giving up too much. The Ottoman Empire was effectively being broken into pieces, split up, divided by the Europeans, by the Allies, by the Western powers, who were going to break it up and form new boundaries based on how they wanted it divided, not based on any sort of ethnic, regional, or historical divides between the people that already lived there. But anyways, moving forward. So they signed the treaty, and it caused a surge of national pride as many in the Ottoman Empire felt like they were giving up too much. A war broke out within the nation, and by the time the Turkish War of Independence ended, the people that had signed the treaty had been overthrown, requiring a new treaty to be crafted and signed. And for those of you that don't see what I just did there, I'll explain it further. The primary ethnic group in the Ottoman Empire was the Turks. The Ottoman Empire became present-day Turkey, and a lot of the major ethnic people in the Ottoman Empire were known as the Turkmen. In any case, you should now see why Turkey has issues with the Kurdish. You get what I'm saying. In any case, a new treaty was signed in 1923, and no mention of the Kurds was included in this treaty. The Kurdistan geocultural region was divided in the states that the Ottoman Empire was broken into in the region, with the British mandate of Iraq and the French mandate of Syria, Persia, current day Iran, and the Ottoman Empire, current day Turkey. To this current day, this map still exists with each region of the specific country that was Kurdistan being known as that country's Kurdistan. Iraqi Kurdistan, Syrian Kurdistan, Iranian Kurdistan, and Turkish Kurdistan. But instead of focusing on what the Kurds have done in all these regions, our focus continues forward right now with what is happening between the Kurds and the Turks. So right now, the Kurds make up 15 to 20% of the population of Turkey, with half of all the Kurds in the world living in Turkey and primarily residing in the southeast region known as Turkestan. With the end of the Ottoman Empire and the establishment of the Republic of Turkey, the nation of Turkey transitioned away from caliphates, which caused major unrest amongst the Kurds. As Turkey became a secular government and moved away from religious rule, the cultural views of the Kurds came to be directly at odds with the government that was overseeing them. This resulted in several rebellions from the 1920s onward and growing calls for an independent Kurdistan. Now, the most significant of these rebellions involved the Republic of Ararat. The Republic declared independence in 1927 and proclaimed itself to be a Kurdish sovereign nation. However, the Republic was not recognized by any other states and had no foreign support. And in the 3 years that followed, the government of Turkey mobilized 66,000 troops and 100 aircraft, putting the rebellion down hard. And you can go back to the story on Catalonia, which there are some recent developments in Catalonia, so we might need to do an update on that show. But you can go back to the story on Catalonia to hear me rant and rave about sovereignty and how I don't think we're understanding that concept the way we need to be understanding it. In any case, after the suppression of a series of rebellions by Kurdish nationalists, the government of Turkey in 1937 began to take extra steps to solve what they viewed as a Kurdish threat or the Kurdish problem. The government imposed martial law in Kurdish regions of Turkey and encouraged other ethnic groups to settle in the region to water down the Kurdish cultural density and the unity in the area. From 1925 to 1938, 1.5 million Kurds were reported to have been deported or massacred, with villages being set on fire. The area remained under military siege until the 1950s, and foreigners were not allowed to visit the area until 1965. The Kurdish language and culture was outlawed, and words referencing the Kurds and Kurdistan were removed from the dictionary and history. The Kurds had begun to achieve levels of integration into Turkish society in the 1950s, but a coup in 1960 kind of undid all of that, and the Kurds reverted back to their original positions of being less than. Now, during World War II, the Kurds in Iraqi Kurdistan formed 10 companies that supported the British in defeating a pro-Nazi coup attempt in Iraq, which was being ruled at that time by a pro-British government. The Kurds also played a role in the Soviet war machine, working behind the German lines. And this is only mentioned because Donald Trump said that they didn't help us in World War II as a defense of his pulling the troops out, which is an interesting defense considering he is considered a draft dodger. And they did, in fact, fight on the side of the Allies in World War II. But anyways, Turkish oppression of the Kurds through the 1970s became more and more intense. By 1965, Kurdish culture wasn't just banned, it was criminalized. And not just the culture, but also political ideas that advocated for a Kurdish state or for the Kurds in general. Singing a song in Kurdish was a punishable offense. In 1984, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK, which gets its initials from the Kurdish words used in the name, which was organized by students in 1978, made its public declaration as a Kurdish military and political organization with the goal of creating an independent Kurdish state. Based in Turkey and Iraq, the organization began launching attacks to free Kurdish people from oppression in 1984, and they continue to do that to this day. Now, since the PKK first announced the Kurdish uprising in 1984, There have been more than 40,000 deaths, and in that time, there has also been an abundance of political and social evolution. The PKK, which started out with social leanings towards Marxism, would leave that ideology behind for a more socialistic view of the nation they wanted to establish for themselves. They also began attacking Kurdish clans that weren't with them, adopting the "if you're not with me, you're against me" view in some regards. The poverty of the Kurdish regions in Turkey, combined with the state-sponsored atrocities and PKK hostilities, caused the region to become depopulated. Kurds began moving to other regions of the nation, and from 1984 to 1999, there was open war between the PKK and Turkey, and the PKK was labeled a terrorist organization by the Turkish government and its NATO ally, the U.S. of A. At the same time that many nations were recognizing the PKK as a terrorist organization, the European Court of Human Rights was condemning Turkey for thousands of human rights abuses, including acts on Kurdish civilians like torture, forced displacement, village destruction, and disappeared Kurdish journalists. Leyla Zana was elected to parliament in Turkey in 1994, and after she finished swearing in her oath in Turkish, she added in Kurdish, "I take this oath for the brotherhood of the Turkish and Kurdish peoples." She served 10 years in prison for that add-on. Turkey continued and continues to view the Kurds as a threat to the unity of their nation, a sentiment that began during the time of their Ottoman forefathers. Zana was actually sentenced to 15 years, but was released early as a condition for Turkey to have a chance at joining the EU. There was a ceasefire in 2000 between the PKK and Turkey, with the PKK announcing they would try peaceful methods of achieving their goals. But hostilities continued both politically and militarily, spurring a civil war inside the PKK amongst the reformers who wanted the organization to demilitarize altogether, and the traditionalists who wanted to end the ceasefire and return to fighting. The traditionalists won, and the fighting resumed officially. The traditionalists believed that without the military activity, the political activity was pointless. And during the time of the ceasefire, the Turkish government was ignoring PKK calls for diplomacy and discussion anyway. From 2004 to 2012, the PKK resistance looked differently than it did before. Because they didn't have the resources they had once enjoyed and they lacked a sponsor or foreign backing, they transitioned into a more guerrilla style of fighting. Smaller units and hit-and-run tactics were deployed, with them no longer attempting to hold territory. The PKK also began launching attacks from Iraq during this time. The Turkish government during this period blamed the PKK for various bombings, with the PKK denying most of them. Both sides also issued different numbers for casualties during conflicts. Turkey launched offensive across the Iraqi border to destroy the Kurds, which prompted involvement from the Kurds in Iran, who put their fights with the Iranian government to the side in order to unite in the fight against Turkey. Kurds were being oppressed and persecuted in all four of the nations they existed in, but Turkey was providing them all with reasons to unite. Through all of this, the Kurds were still seeing advances politically, growing in power and influence in Turkey. The Turkish government responded to these advances by easing up on its bans on Kurdish culture. In 2015, what has become known as the third phase of the Kurdish-Turkish conflict started. Following another failed ceasefire and frustration as the Turkish government refused to let the PKK send reinforcement to Kurdish fighters fighting ISIS in Syria with the U.S., this wave of conflict saw the Kurdish forces behaving similarly to the second wave, with the added component of holding territory. And that brings us up to December 2018, when Donald Trump, following a phone call to the Turkish president, announced that he would pull U.S. forces out of Syria. However, the huge political backlash he received from politicians, the media, other nations, and the U.S. military caused him to go back on it. However, in October 2019, he again announced he would pull U.S. troops out of Syria following a phone call with the president of Turkey, and this time he followed through. But while we have talked about Turkey and the Kurds, we still have to answer one more question before we could put all this together. What were the Kurds doing in Syria? In Syria, the Kurds also faced extreme oppression, the same as everywhere else. However, the Syrian government also supported Kurdish organizations, including the PKK, in the 1980s and 90s as a means of destabilizing their neighbors in the region. Syria went so far as to allow the leader of the PKK to have safe haven in Syria and allowed them to launch operations from Syria, as well as allowing a Kurdish leader to found the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, or the PUK, in order to combat oppression in Iraq. The Kurds in Syria weren't as united as those in Turkey, making them less of a threat, and they were also smaller in number. Situated in the northeast of Syria, they are the largest ethnic minority in the country, numbering about 2 million. But the land of Syria holds special places for the Kurds, as the great Muslim leader Saladin was a Kurd that founded the Ayyubid dynasty, which built great castles and buildings in the entire region of the Middle East and Northeast Africa, some of which still stand in Damascus, which is situated in modern-day Syria. Now, while the Kurds did face oppression in Syria, it was somewhat different. The Syrian government did ban Kurdish culture like Turkey, and they also denied the right to Syrian nationality, making the Kurds there effectively invisible people with no rights in any land. Children with Kurdish names either weren't registered or were given Arabic names instead by the government. And in 1998, the Syrian government banned Kurdish political parties and organizations, including those they once supported. The Kurds in Syria began strategizing, and 5 years later, in 2003, they had formed the Democratic Union Party, or the PYD. Turkey claims that the PYD was formed in secret by the PKK, but others say that the PYD is a naturally occurring Syrian organization. Due to the PYD's ability to mobilize large numbers of people, the Syrian government viewed them as a major threat, much in the same light that the Turkish government did. And Syria treated PYD members with a special intensity of violence and oppression that was worse than it treated Kurds that weren't a member of the PYD. But still, all Kurds faced oppression. The PYD organized a large protest in 2007 in order to prevent Turkey from invading Iraqi Kurdistan and to show their disapproval of the Syrian government's approval of that invasion, which resulted in Syrian forces opening fire on protesters with live ammunition, killing one and injuring others. Things persisted in this manner until the start of the Syrian civil war in 2011, with a few instances of Kurdish resistance sprinkled in. Now, it should be mentioned at this point that the French employed a divide-and-conquer strategy in Syria that saw them encouraging Kurdish and other minority groups to gain power and advocate for themselves against the dominant ethnic group in the nation. They used the Kurds as members of their police forces and conscripted them into local military organizations. The British did similar things in the regions they controlled as a part of their mandate. And the mandate system was supposed to be different from colonialization because it was not a system of permanent control. The idea was for a country to control and sponsor another long enough for the country being sponsored to manage its own affairs, and then for the country doing the sponsoring to pull out. However, it would be extremely naive, in my opinion, to think that the British and the French, along with the U.S. and other allies, didn't put things in place to ensure that the Ottoman Empire didn't reform. Stroking the flames of ethnic tensions is something that European nations have done the world over in order to keep threats against them from forming or reforming. However, moving on and moving into the Syrian civil war, the PYD found itself joining up with various Kurdish umbrella organizations, including the Kurdish Patriotic Movement, the Kurdish National Council, the KNC, and the Kurdistan Communities Union, the KCK, which included the PKK from Turkey. In 2012, when the Syrian government pulled most of its troops out of Kurdistan in order to fight rebels elsewhere, the Kurds placed more resources in the hands of the People's Protection Units, the YPG, in order to provide security for Kurdish regions in Syria. This caused the YPG and their sister group, the Women's Protection Units, the YPJ, to become the dominant Kurdish fighting force in Syria. And seeing as how the YPG and the YPJ were created under the PYD, This means that the PYD was the dominant Kurdish fighting force in the region. However, their control over Syrian Kurdistan did cause some problems with other Kurdish groups, especially the purists and the nationalists. The PYD wanted to create a multicultural safe haven for all, and they eventually ended some of their agreements with the other Kurdish factions. The area that the PYD controlled has been renamed Rojava by the Kurds, and its existence on the Turkish border is viewed as completely unacceptable to Turkey, who also views the Syrian government's pulling back from Kurdish areas as the Syrian government making a deal and ceding territory to the Kurds, which is also something that is completely unacceptable to Turkey. In 2014, the U.S. began supporting the PYD, but only indirectly and definitely conditionally through its support of the YPG and YPJ. The U.S. entered the picture because things weren't going well in the battle against ISIS for the U.S. As the Syrian civil war continued and chaos spread, ISIS was using this opportunity to consolidate power and territory. That is, until they ran up against the Kurdish province of Kobani and its main city of Kobani. Now, Kobani exists in the Kurdish-controlled region of Rojava, and the Kurds weren't having it. Things started going well for ISIS at first as they captured more than 300 towns and villages in the region, displacing 300,000 Kurds who fled into Turkey. But the Kurds regrouped with other Syrian rebel groups and began fighting back, this time also supported by American airstrikes. In January of 2015, the Kurds had retaken the city, but many villages and towns in the region remained under ISIS control. By April of 2015, the Kurds had retaken most of the region, and the battle was seen as a turning point for the battle against ISIS in America. However, this made things difficult for Turkey, who had allowed the PYD, the Syrian Kurds, to use Turkish lands in the early stages of the Syrian civil war. But when Turkey refused to help Kurdish fighters fight against ISIS in the Battle of Kobani, while also not allowing the Turkish Kurds to support the Syrian Kurds, well, we talked about that earlier. It caused an end to the ceasefire between Turkey and the PKK, but also caused an issue because America needed bodies on the ground to fight ISIS and didn't want to send its own troops. With Turkey unwilling to indirectly defend Kurdish lands and other rebel forces in the region proving unreliable or unstable, that only left the YPG-YPJ and their parent organization of the PYD for the U.S. to rely on. But Turkey saw the PYD and the PKK as the same organization and began to view the PYD as a terrorist organization the same way it viewed the PKK. As such, Turkey will not allow an autonomous region of Kurds on its border, and if that means invading other countries, they are more than willing to do it. In 2016, the Turkish government stated that the destruction of the PYD was a policy arm of the government. This put the U.S. in a delicate position because they had basically become an ally to an organization that was connected to another organization that they viewed as a terrorist organization and that their NATO ally of Turkey had pledged to destroy. But Turkey wasn't willing to help the U.S. with the ISIS problem in the region because doing so would have advanced a group they considered to be a terroristic threat. Obama made regular calls to the Turkish president to try to appease the outraged nation and put a $12 million bounty on PYD leaders. The U.S. also tried to distance the PYD from the PKK and the YPG-YPJ from the PKK by having the YPG-YPJ announce themselves as the Syrian Defense Force, the SDF. None of it worked. Then we come to Donald Trump, who has an affinity for the type of authoritarian leader that the president of Turkey is. Which is why in 2018, after 4 years of the U.S. working and fighting side by side with Kurdish forces, training them and learning from them, and various incidents of the U.S. soldiers being told to remove Kurdish patches from their uniforms, the soldiers view them as allies. The government wants to view them as proxies. Donald Trump was persuaded to remove U.S. troops from the area in a phone call, just one. But as stated earlier, he went back on that after fallout. But earlier this year in 2019, after another phone call, he followed through quickly before any backlash could occur. And as the U.S. pulled out, the small number of troops it had in the region, Turkey moved in. Now, Turkey is also facing some economic issues in hopes that resettling the Syrian refugees into the created buffer zone will ease some of that economic tension, and hopes to push deep enough into Syria to secure enough land to settle 2 to 3 million refugees that have fled to Turkey. The Kurds have called the U.S. pullout a stab in the back, something that they recognize as a pattern when dealing with the U.S. In addition to some of the other things I mentioned earlier, the U.S. also supported the Kurds when it was feared that Saddam Hussein would become a Soviet asset. When the U.S. was sure that wasn't going to happen, they stopped supporting the Kurds cold turkey immediately. But this one was a bit different. The U.S. had been training, arming, and fighting alongside the Kurds, and the Kurds, for their part, have been dying. More than 10,000 Kurds have died in the past 5 years. And they had also been directing their fight towards ISIS while also acting as guards to more than 10,000 ISIS fighters and 70,000 ISIS families. But since the U.S. pullout, several of those fighters have been set free, and ISIS is looking to reconstitute itself. The Kurds have gone to the Syrian government for protection against the Turks. Russia has stepped in to fill the power vacuum left by the U.S., and thousands of Kurds have been killed or injured, with many more being displaced. And all of this happened in a matter of days. The situation got so bad, so fast, that the U.S. stepped back in and negotiated a ceasefire between the Kurds and the Turks, that many people on both sides say isn't being honored, in order to stop the international fallout against the U.S. Many have said that it was less than 100 troops in the region, and that isn't enough to stop the war. But Turkey did not want to launch an offensive and potentially kill or endanger American soldiers. That would have put them directly at odds with the U.S. So now the Kurds are allied with Syria, Russia, and Iran, three nations that the U.S. is not fond of. And as the talks during the ceasefire continue, it's looking more and more like the Kurds once again will not have a real voice in the proceedings. Many are calling this a U.S. negotiated surrender of the Kurds. And while the Kurds have said they will continue to administer the regions they control, we don't know how long they will be able to control anything. And U.S. trustworthiness has taken another huge hit as another deal made by the Obama administration has been destroyed by the Trump administration. And while some have argued that he was right to pull us out of the endless situations in the Middle East, that isn't necessarily true. While he did pull some soldiers out of Syria, he deployed more to Saudi Arabia. And he justifies this by saying that the Saudis are paying for us to be there, basically acknowledging that the U.S. military is available for hire. And on the whole, U.S. presence in the Middle East has gone up during the Trump administration, not down. But for Trump, this move has larger implications as he moves to face his impeachment. He may have given many Republicans in the Senate the cover they need to vote to impeach him. And this has been another episode of Lessons from the Screen.
Lessons from the Screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.
I want to thank you guys once again for listening to Lessons from the Screen. I want to ask you guys to go to, if you have an Android device, go to the Google Play Store, type in Freedom Train Radio. You'll see the logo of the train. Download the app, get the app. It'll keep you up to date on all of the shows and everything else that's going on here at the Freedom Train Network. Also, head on over to www.freedomtrainradio.com and check out all the shows. Leave comments, leave reviews. If you want to reach us or say anything to us, that's the best way to do it. Because if you just reach out through your social media, your a podcast listening app or YouTube or whatever, we don't check all of those things, but we do check the website. So go there. Also, I just want to thank you guys once again for tuning in, and see you next week. Let me know what you think about the show you just listened to. Let me know if you agree, disagree, you felt like I missed something, whatever it is. Just holla at your boy, and I will see you next week. or whenever the next show comes out. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show again, hit us up on the Freedom Train Radio website and let us know that you're interested in sponsoring a particular show or the entire network.